headlines. Iran reiterates that the U.S. is to blame for the JCPOA status quo, censuring some signatories' silence on Washington's excessive demands. The U.N. calls for talks on Hodeidah as the Saudi-backed militants have withdrawn from around the Yemeni port city despite the kingdom's intensified attacks. And Israeli forces raid several shops of Palestinians near the Ghalandia checkpoint north of occupied Al-Quds. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour. Iran says there is consensus among the participants of the 2015 nuclear deal that the U.S. is to blame for the current state of the accord. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a phone call with his Italian counterpart, Luigi Di Maio. Iran's top diplomat noted that some of the participants to the deal have acted irresponsibly by staying silent in the face of the U.S.'s excessive demands. He said their inaction led to the current situation. Di Maio, for his part, expressed hope that the upcoming Vienna talks will end in the intended results and help Tehran and Rome boost their bilateral ties. Earlier, we were joined by political commentator Richard Becker, who gave us his thoughts on the Iran nuclear deal and the developments since the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the accord.
After Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, announced the unilateral and I believe illegal withdrawal from what was essentially a treaty, the partners of the United States who were part of it and members of the Security Council, meaning, of course, Britain and France and also Germany, which is not in the Security Council, but one of the negotiating partners in this, that they all said to Iran, no, no, stay in the agreement. We'll find ways to overcome the problems that you now face because the U.S. has pulled out. And it didn't happen. It didn't happen in any kind of a significant way at all. So the deafening silence, I think, is the correct way to put what the allies of the United States, how they have reacted to the United States' unilateral withdrawal from the treaty. I think the Iranian government has gone out of its way to maintain adherence to the agreement, and we had Biden, when he was running for president, indicating that he would restore the U.S. to the deal, but never intended to do that without exacting more sanctions, which the Iranian government understandably is not willing to do.
A United Nations monitoring mission in Yemen has called on the warring sides to hold new talks over the western port city of Hodeidah. The mission said the withdrawal of Saudi-backed forces from areas near the strategic city and the Yemeni army's advancement there marks a shift on the front lines. It added that the developments warrant fresh discussions between the two sides. The call came a day after Saudi warplanes targeted an area east of the city of Hais in Hodeidah province, killing 3 civilians and injuring 7 others. That's despite a UN-backed truce reached in 2018 that called for the cessation of fighting along the Hodeidah front. The Ansarullah movement has said it expects the deal to lead to peace, but instead, Saudi Arabia has continued to violate the ceasefire, killing and injuring thousands of Yemenis ever since. Well, that is why the World Health Organization has voiced concern about the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen, warning that 75% of children there suffer from acute malnutrition. The WHO also said that over 16 million Yemenis are facing food insecurity. That's almost half the country's total population. Previously, the UN Security Council warned about the increasing risk of severe famine in Yemen, exacerbated by the poor economic situation. Yemen has been mired in crisis, or mirroring a crisis, since the Saudi-led coalition launched a devastating war on the country in 2015. Around 80% of the country's population is now in need of humanitarian assistance. on the line, Eric Wolberg. He is an author and journalist joining us from Toronto to discuss this story further. 75% of Yemeni children suffer from acute malnutrition. Over half of the population are food insecure. How do you comment on that?
Well, it's terrible, and it could be ended immediately if the U.S., if Biden would just stand by his election promise to stop funding the Saudis. But as with many of his promises, he has backtracked and not fulfilled them. So this is another one where he's gone ahead and proposed further funding of Saudi aircraft, and Ilhan Omar, the congresswoman, has put forward a motion to stop funding the Saudi war machine. This is the same motion that went that was three times vetoed by Trump, and now it looks like it's going to come up for Biden, and will Biden continue with Trump's failed policy, or will he take some initiative and do something that he promised?
And if you couple this with the fact that Saudi Arabia has been launching airstrikes on Yemen, killing civilians, most recently in Hodeidah and also in Shabwa province, including children, women, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen is dire. Why not anybody, hold Saudi Arabia to account here?
Well, there has been some development. Hodeidah, Saudi-backed forces have withdrawn from the port there. And this was one of the conditions that the Houthi, they insisted that before any kind of real truce can happen, there has to be an end to the blockade of aid. So perhaps now there will be some movement if Hodeidah stays free and aid is coming through, then this should move the process forward.
Are you optimistic that Saudi Arabia will back off?
Well, it won't do it on its own, but Biden refuses to meet. It's scandalous, really. Biden refuses to meet with bin Salman because of the Khashoggi. Again, he promised in his election that he would not meet with this bin Salman and to recognize him as leader of Saudi Arabia. And so far, he's kept that pledge, but it doesn't really improve the situation. It doesn't change the war in Yemen. So Biden makes these futile gestures without doing any real policy. So I don't know if perhaps there will be this move on the part of Congress to stop the funding. Maybe that will end the U.S. funding. That is the only way you're going to get the Saudis to back down, if they finally see that they aren't getting their arms as they wanted before.
Many thanks for your contribution. I've been talking to Eric Wolberg. He is an author and journalist joining us from Toronto. Moving on. Israeli forces have demolished Palestinian shops near the Qalandia checkpoint north of occupied Al-Quds. Israeli bulldozers, backed by the regime's troops, razed three shops. Israel has a long history of tearing down Palestinian homes and structures under different pretexts, including lack of construction permit. Tel Aviv pushes ahead with its demolition drive despite international criticism. A month ago, Israeli authorities wrecked all structures in the village of Araghib. Palestinians say the move is part of the regime's land grab policy to expand its illegal settlements. A UN report shows Israel's confiscation of Palestinian homes in Al-Quds and the West Bank has increased by 21% in 2021 compared to last year. Israel's top court has dismissed an appeal for the immediate release of a hunger-striking Palestinian prisoner who is at imminent risk of death. This is the fourth time the Israeli Supreme Court has rejected a petition submitted for the release of Kayat Fasfas. The Palestinian Commission for Prisoners says the rejection shows the Israeli officials' indifference and deliberate criminal disregard for the life of inmates. 34-year-old Fasfas has been on hunger strike for 125 days in protest at his indefinite detention without charge or trial. Four other Palestinians are also refusing food for months over their so-called administrative detention. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has expressed support for the detainees and called for urgent international action to save their lives. Earlier, we discussed Israel's much-criticized administrative detention policy with human rights activist Bruce Katz. He explains how such practices can only be employed by totalitarian and apartheid regimes.
Basically, what it points to is simply the disregard for Palestinians as human beings. And you know, the question of Palestinian prisoners is at the very crux of the battle against apartheid. And it should be remembered, these are the vast majority of Palestinians in the Israeli carceral system are political prisoners. And when we talk about administrative detention, it should be remembered that administrative detention is something that can be repeated every 6 months. Palestinians are simply taken off the street. There are no formal charges. There is no proof. There's no due process. You know, the only places you can have things such a system of arbitrary incarceration is in a totalitarian state. And that is essentially what Israel is. As for the ruling of the Supreme Court, let us remember that this is the Supreme Court of an apartheid state, and the function of that Supreme Court is to lend a legal, or rather a pseudo-legal, legitimacy to criminal actions on the part of the apartheid regime in Tel Aviv that runs that state.
Welcome back. The European Union has decided to impose fresh sanctions against Belarus amid deepening tensions with Minsk over a migrant crisis. The decision was made during a meeting of EU foreign ministers in Brussels, where they agreed to amend the 2020 sanctions against Belarus. Before the meeting, one of the ministers accused Minsk of violating human rights, saying severe economic sanctions against it is inevitable. The EU accuses Belarus of using migrants to breach its objectives against the bloc, an accusation Minsk has dismissed as absurd. About 4,000 people have been stranded at the country's border with Poland. Warsaw has deployed additional guards at the border to push back the migrants. The UK government has raised the country's terror alert level from substantial to severe following a car explosion in the northwest city of Liverpool on the weekend. The announcement came after police declared the fatal explosion a terror incident. Saitu Raza reports from Liverpool.
A weekend terror incident in Liverpool, UK. One man killed, one injured, and four aged between 20 and 29 arrested under the controversial counterterrorism law. The mood among some, one of shock and disbelief.
Honestly, shock. You know, I couldn't believe it. I've never been around anything like this in my life. I moved up here just for uni, so to have something happen like this, you know, right next to my accommodation is very scary.
Police say the passenger, 32-year-old Iman Al-Suwaylmin, carried a homemade explosive device into the taxi. The driver, David Perry, who locked the suspect in the car to prevent a worse situation, escaped with minor injuries. The timing has had everyone thinking. Just 2 minutes before Remembrance Sunday, when the entire country remembers Britons killed in wars. In Monday, the government raised the terror threat level from substantial to severe, warning residents to be vigilant.
The police have now confirmed that this is being treated as a terrorist attack, and while the investigation continues at pace, you will understand that I can't comment on the details of the case or its motivation, but it is a stark reminder of the need for us all to remain utterly vigilant.
There are still three police cordons in the city, one here at the Women's Hospital, the site of the explosion, and the two major streets elsewhere. Police are still investigating to establish the circumstances of what happened. Police are still searching two addresses for more clues into the motivation behind the incident. Saeed Pariza, Liverpool.
Russia has described as provocative the recent military drills by the U.S. and its NATO allies in the Black Sea, warning that the exercises have increased tensions between Moscow and NATO. President Vladimir Putin made the remark in a phone call with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron. They also raised the issue of Ukraine and expressed their dissatisfaction, with Putin calling the situation their worsening. Russia and the West are at loggerheads over a host of issues, including the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Earlier, Washington raised the alarm over alleged Russian military activities near Ukraine's border. But Russia has denied the accusations of fueling unrest in the neighboring country. Outer space is increasingly becoming the new theater of warfare between Russia and the U.S. In the latest flare-up, Washington has accused Moscow of carrying out an anti-satellite weapons test, an exercise it described as dangerous and irresponsible.
In addition, this test will significantly increase the risk to astronauts and cosmonauts on the International Space Station, as well as to other human spaceflight activities. Russia's dangerous and irresponsible behavior jeopardizes the long-term sustainability of outer space and clearly demonstrates that Russia's claims of opposing the weaponization of space are disingenuous and hypocritical. The United States will work with our allies and partners to respond to Russia's...
Price said the test was carried out against one of Russia's own satellites, generating over 1,500 pieces of trackable orbital debris. He vowed that the U.S. would work with its allies and partners to respond to the move. The cloud of debris caused by the alleged weapons test forced the International Space Station's crew to prepare for possible evacuation. Russia has not yet commented on the allegations, but the Russian space agency, Roscosmos, sought to allay concerns. It said the object that moved away, or has moved away, I should say, from the ISS and the station is in the green zone. The U.S. carried out the first anti-satellite tests in 1959. China, Russia, and India have also tested the missiles so far. Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
English Radio.
Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
On October 7th, the U.S. Navy announced that 5 days earlier, on October 2nd, its Sea Wolf-class nuclear-powered and nuclear weapons-capable submarine, USS Connecticut, had hit an unidentified object in the South China Sea. The U.S. Navy's announcement was brief and vague. It did not say what the submarine hit or where, only that it was operating in international waters in the Indo-Pacific region. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Mark J. Valencia, an internationally recognized maritime policy analyst, political commentator, and consultant focused on Asia, titled, U.S. Nuclear Subaccident Warns of Potential for Catastrophe. The article was published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay tuned. The recent U.S. nuclear sub-accident demonstrated operator incompetence, government hypocrisy, and the environment threat posed by such operations in the South China Sea, On October 7th, the U.S. Navy announced that, 5 days earlier on October 2nd, its Seawolf-class nuclear-powered and nuclear-weapons-capable submarine USS Connecticut had hit an unidentified object in the South China Sea. According to the announcement, the submarine remained in a safe and stable condition and its nuclear propulsion plant and spaces were not affected and remained fully operational. The vessel eventually proceeded on the surface under its own power of Guam. There, the damage is being assessed. The U.S. Navy's announcement was brief and vague. It did not say what the submarine hit or where, only that it was operating in international waters in the Indo-Pacific region. It turned out to be a seamount in the South China Sea. The incompetence of the sub commanders was admitted. In removing two officers and the chief of the boat from their positions, Vice Admiral Carl Thomas, commander of the U.S. 7th Fleet, detailed their errors. He determined that sound judgment, prudent decision-making, and adherence to required procedures in navigation planning, watch team execution, and risk management could have prevented the incident. As a former U.S. attack sub-commander put it, not everything goes right all the time, and even pros have had bad days. In this case, they had a very bad day. U.S. hypocrisy was painfully apparent. The U.S. has frequently accused China of a lack of transparency in military matters. This is a red herring. Military transparency favors the stronger players because they can learn the weaknesses of others while intimidating them by allowing calculated glimpses of their superiority. In this instance, the U.S. was anything but transparent regarding the details, even though the accident generated worries about radiation affecting its friends and allies in the region. China's foreign ministry spokesperson said the United States should clarify more details of the occurrence, including the specific location, the intention of its navigation, what kind of object the sub had struck, whether it caused a nuclear leak that would contaminate the marine environment. It's responsible and displays a lack of transparency on the part of the U.S. to deliberately delay and conceal the details of the accident. The U.S. Navy said the delay in reporting the incident was due to concerns about keeping the damaged sub safe and ensuring a thorough investigation of the incident. The Navy refused to specify the location of the accident due to operation security. But it is not clear why reporting the incident right away and its location would endanger the sub's safety and compromise the investigation. One possibility is that the accident occurred in waters under China's jurisdiction and the U.S. feared that China might demand to take over or at least participate in the investigation. In other words, the sub may have been violating China's laws and rights in its 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone, that is EEZ. On October 3rd, the day after the accident, a Seawolf sub was spotted on the surface 43 miles southeast of the Paracel Islands, so the accident might well have occurred within China's 200 NM EEZ around the Paracels. According to sub manufacturer General Dynamics Electric Boat, the mission of the Seawolf class of submarines include surveillance, intelligence collection, and special warfare, especially in shallow waters. China has military installations on the Paracels. It also has a very sensitive naval base at the Yanlin on Hainan, where it bases its nuclear-powered and nuclear-capable submarines. These circumstances again raise questions of what the Connecticut was doing and where. Adding to the worries, a month after the incident, the U.S. deployed a radiation-sniffing aircraft, a Boeing WC-135, over the South China Sea, a relatively rare occurrence. The primary mission of such an aircraft is to collect atmospheric samples to detect nuclear radiation. But if there was no leakage of radiation from the sump, what prompted the mission? It would be in the region's public interest for the U.S. to disclose what it found. The incident also raised the possibility of a catastrophic incident involving a nuclear-powered or nuclear-armed vessel that releases radiation into the environment. This is not hyperbole. Globally, 9 nuclear submarines have sunk. The Soviet Navy lost 5, one of which sank twice. The Russian Navy too and the U.S. Navy too. These were worst-case scenarios, but non-catastrophic accidents, once rare, are becoming more frequent as the numbers of such vessels increase. In 2003, the Los Angeles-class USS Hartford grounded entering a port in Sardinia. In January 2005, the Los Angeles-class USS San Francisco struck a seamount near the Caroline Islands that did not appear on the charts the crew was using to navigate without active sonar. The sub sustained severe damage to its forward ballast tanks and sonar dome, and the vessel was almost lost. Again in March 2009, the Hartford collided with a U.S. amphibious dock in the Strait of Hormuz. In November 2015, an Ohio-class sub grounded as it was entering its port of King Bay, Georgia. This is what the public knows, but there may have been many more near misses. The worst U.S. nuclear submarine disasters were the April 1963 loss of the Thresher and the May 1968 loss of the Scorpion. Both sank in the North Atlantic with all hands as well as their nuclear reactors and torpedoes. As more nuclear subs are built and deployed, the chance of a catastrophic accident increases. Including in the South China Sea, the U.S. deployed nuclear subs at least 11 times last year. Other countries also operate nuclear submarines in the South China Sea, including France and perhaps the U.K. as part of its Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier strike group. India, which is now sending warships to the South China Sea, has only one nuclear-powered sub, but is building more. China already has 4 Jin-class nuclear submarines and is hoping to acquire another 4 by 2030. The AUKUS agreement for the U.S. and the U.K. to supply nuclear submarine technology to Australia for operations that include the South China Sea will add to the mix. Operating submarines is difficult and dangerous. Most subs have both active and passive sonar. Active sonar sends out acoustic pulses or pings. The ping will reflect back if it hits an object like a whale, a ship, a seamount, or another submarine. But subs operating in stealth mode turn off their active sonar because the ping could give away their location. The South China Sea is a difficult operating environment for submarines. It is particularly noisy and has rather complex and shifting bottom topography. Much of it is shallower than 200 meters, especially the approaches to the China coast. This means subs have to operate in a narrow zone between a safe distance from the bottom, but deep enough to avoid detection. An accident that released significant radiation into the marine environment would be a nightmare for the regional countries. Southeast Asians rely more heavily on fish as a primary source of dietary protein and income generation than any other people in the world. Such an accident could damage the marine food supply for all littoral countries. It would probably create an aversion to eating seafood, even if it were safe. Judging from Fukushima disaster in Japan, although the radiation may be insignificant or rapidly decreased to safe levels, the reputational damage to the fishery would last much longer. The South China Sea coastal countries have legitimate cause for concern. If the countries with nuclear subs continue this risky behavior in other countries' EEZs, they may be violating the duty mandated by the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea to pay due regard to the rights and duties of coastal states, such as protecting the environment and not presenting a hazard to shipping. Risky behavior that endangers others requires a robust response. It may even be eventually necessary for countries to establish the equivalent of sea defense identification zones, SEADIZ, for submarines. Like air defense identification zones, their function would be to serve as early warning areas. In such zones, submarines, manned or unmanned, would be requested to identify themselves, their destination and mission. If they did not, then they would be treated as potentially hostile and closely tracked wherever they went. Such a drastic step could be obviated by more responsible and transparent operations of nuclear submarines. However, as the Connecticut accident and its aftermath show, this is highly unlikely.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody. For your information, the holy city of Qom in Iran is indeed the foremost center of diffusion of true Islamic knowledge, with students from all over the world coming to acquire the bezels of wisdom. Here is what the Prophet's 16th fallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, has said regarding the city, which is blessed by the holy shrine of his granddaughter, Hazrat Fatima Ma'sumeh, peace upon her. Indeed, God has a sanctuary, and that is Mecca. The messenger of God, Prophet Muhammad, has a sanctuary, and that is Medina. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, has a sanctuary, and that is Kufa in Iraq. And we, the Ahlul Bayt, have a sanctuary, and that is Qom.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen's vision when it comes to practicing social justice among the Muslims of his time or the people of his time. And we can see that very clear in the words and the actions of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi. One of the first things that the Imam alayhi salam did, and his approach when he went to Iraq to be the governor or the Khalifa, is that he rejected the division based on race or ethnicity. That was something that was rejected by Amir al-Mu'mineen. And even the nationalist throughout the Arabian kind of culture, where the nobles, those who have noble origin, they would prefer themselves over others, he did that, made no difference to him at all. He says, "Man abta'a bihi amaluh lam yusra' bihi nasabuh." When it comes to your actions, if you don't do any good actions, your lineage, your origin, whether it's a noble family or not, will not do you any good. So one should not be seeking anything from Amir al-Mu'mineen based on his nobility or origin, and trying to have this division. So he tried to eliminate and eradicate this kind of notion between people, that they are from a noble family and these guys are not. And then he says, وَالدَّلِيلُ عَنْدِ عَزِيزِ. Those who are oppressed, those who are being humiliated in society, to me they are honored. In my presence they are honored. حَتَّى أَأَخُذَ الْحَقَّ لَهُ. Until I take their rights for them. Because they are of, a less noble family or not known people, and people look down at them, he says, I will take their rights for them. To me, they are honored because they are, at the end of the day, human beings, mu'mineen. So I will take their rights. And he says, وَالْقَوِيُّ عَنْدِي ضَعِيفٌ. And those who are in power, those who think they are, strong and have, things to fight with and things to bring forward. I'm of this family. I am of this race. I'm an Arab. I'm from Quraysh. He's like, this kind of strength that you have, to me, it is nothing. He says, وَالْقَوِيُّ عَنْدِي ضَعِيفٌ. Those who think they are strong, in my sight, to me, they are weak. حَتَّى أَأْخُذَ الْحَقَّ مِنْهُ. Until I take the right from them. So you see clearly Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he's saying, I will stand with the truth. I will stand with justice. I will stand with fairness and equality. And I will not make any differences between people based on their race or ethnicity. To him, it meant absolutely nothing. And then he made it clear and he says, أَطْهَرُ النَّاسَ أَعْرَاقَ أَحْسَنَهُمْ أَخْلَاقًا. When it comes to the purest people, when it comes to races, the purest form of race is ethics. If you have good ethics, if you got good morals, then you are the best of people. And then he says, وَأَفْضَلُ النَّاسَ أَنْفَعَهُمْ النَّاسَ. And the best amongst people is the one who is more beneficial to people. Those are the ones he respected. Those are the ones who thought they were doing the right thing. Not because of your lineage, not because of your family name, not because of your title. To Amir al-Mu'mineen, it meant absolutely nothing. And he says, I will take the right from those who think they are powerful, and I will give it to those who are weak. Let's continue after a short break, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Now, so the concept of fairness and equality in the sight of Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, it rejects race and ethnicity from whatever aspect it is, positive or negative. It's completely rejected in his sight. But he used to make it as a way to connect people, as a way to bring people together, not divide them. So he says, As-sabiqu khamsa, those who came first are five. Fa'ana sabiqu al-Arab, for I am the first of the Arabs to be a believer in the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Was-Salman sabiqu al-Furs, and Salman is the first amongst or from the Persian. Was-Suhayb سابق الروم, and from the Romans we have Suhaib. وبلال سابق الحبشة, and Bilal is the first from Abyssinia. وخباط سابق النبط, and خباط is the first that comes from Nabt, which is in Syria. So he says, these people, me, Salman, Suhaib al-Rumi, Bilal, we were from different ethnicities, different cultures, different races, yet we came all together under one banner, and we treat each other similarly, and we treat each other fairly, and we treat each other with fairness. So if you guys want to have any of this notion between you that, oh, I'm better than him, I am white and he's black, or I'm Arab, he's Persian, he said that made no difference between us. Because both Persians, Arabs, Romans, Abyssinia, and Sham, they all came together. They were all the same. They were treated the same. For example, they didn't look at Bilal and said, well, he's black, for example, from Abyssinia. We and blacks are slaves, therefore we will not, you know, we will look at him different. Or, for example, Salman, because he's a Persian, therefore we're going to treat him differently. Or Suhaib, because he was a Roman, therefore we treat him differently. Absolutely the contrary. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi and the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he treated them with fairness and equality. In fact, it's not the Prophet, it's not Amir al-Mu'mineen, that's just the teaching of Islam. That what Islam teaches. Islam says no races, no ethnicities, no nothing. You're all the same in the eyes and the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Akramakum andallah atqakum, the most honored amongst you, human beings in general, is the more pious. If you are pious, the higher you are in piety, the better you are in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Not your wealth, not your lineage, not your family, not your title, nothing. And Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, and he had to deal with this concept heavily during his rule. Because people were still living in the dark ages. They still have the old back pagan mentality where it is based on tribal mentality that my tribe is better than other tribes. And the biggest names that we have in history, those who call themselves companions of the Prophet, he had to deal with them and this backward mentality where they were asking for a lot of things that wasn't theirs. And he had to stop against them. To the point where some of them decided to go to war with him because they could not handle and accept the justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen and the fairness and equality of Amir al-Mu'mineen. They could not handle it, so they had to wage war, and first of which was the Battle of the Camel, and then Safin, and then Nahrawan, until they had to kill Amir al-Mu'mineen in order for them to get their ways. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
The United Arab Emirates, a modern country in the deserts of the Persian Gulf. With four-lane orbital motorways, expensive cars, towering skyscrapers, posh hotels, state-of-the-art shopping centers, and all other aspects of modernity except for one, human rights, even in its basic form. For years, Emirati political activists have been devoutly after this holy grail, endangering their lives and the lives of their family members. On the fifth day of November this year, a tragic death in the UAE grabbed the headlines. Mohammed al-Nuaimi, the son of the self-exiled Emirati political dissident Ahmed al-Nuaimi, who was suffering from cerebral palsy, passed away in a hospital in Sharjah. His family, now living in London, didn't dare to come back to the UAE for dear life. The plight of the al-Nuaimis dates back to March 2011, in the heat of the widespread protests in the Arab world. Back then, 132 activists, including Ahmed al-Nuaimi, signed a petition calling for increased political participation and constitutional reforms in the UAE. Soon after, many of them were arrested and tried in a case that became known as the UAE 94. At that point, al-Nuaimi was in the UK on a business trip. Fearing arrest, he decided not to return to the homeland.
There's a great pressure that's being placed on dissidents, if that may be the term used. These dissidents that you talk about are, you know, generally people who do not agree with the form of policies that are mated out by the government. They have a right to express their voices, any speeches and protests. But I believe it's extremely important for anybody to, you know, voice out their concerns.
In 2013, al-Nuaimi was sentenced in absentia to 15 years in prison, and his family were put under a travel ban. In the following years, almost all his family managed to escape the country through a land border and join al-Nuaimi. Mohammed, however, couldn't make it due to his health condition and disability. And despite pressure from rights groups, the Emirati authorities never allowed him to reunite with his family, a desperate act in reprisal for his father's activism.
Well, definitely there's two faces to UAE. and they're following the footsteps of their masters, the Saudi regime. And we all know all those who have been working as human rights activists are very well aware that, you know, they have double standards. There's a standard that they provide for the West, in which they, you know, they succumb to everything that, you know, happily that the Western media would highlight. And what they have been doing is that for such a long time is that they've been hiding behind this mask that they wear. And it seems that they have no conscience when it comes to, you know, even a child such as Mohammed or Noemi.
Earlier this year, the political dissident launched an online campaign using the hashtag Mohammed Baniya, my son Mohammed, calling for Abu Dhabi to lift the travel ban on his paralyzed son after 9 years because he needed specialist care, but the government refused to budge.
I think, obviously, you know, it's a way of silencing any dissent. So instead of people who have a particular political view being, you know, exiled or silenced, their voice or their views or opinions are silenced by threats and restrictions or to their family, as in this case, which really is collective targeting and collective punishment of people for differences of opinion and political views.
Mohammed's death triggered a wave of international condemnation. MENA Rights Group, for example, tweeted, "Another example of the cruelty of the UAE regime and of the suffering caused by travel bans." Mohammed last saw his family when he was 18, but was never allowed to leave the country. His parents and 5 siblings live in exile and could not say goodbye. Rest in peace, Mohammed.
It's double standards all across the board, especially with the UAE. Any place you go to Saudi, and that's the same thing. There's, you know, this whole thing about pleasing the West and, you know, antagonizing its own people has been going on for many, many years. It's not something that's just come across now. But yes, I can see that there is a huge amount of double standards being placed through UAE, and it will be about pleasing their masters in the West.
The fact is, Abu Dhabi has long been targeting the relatives of rights activists and political dissidents. According to We Record, an international human rights platform, the Emirati state has targeted the families of activists and human rights defenders through various measures, including the revocation of nationality, denial of travel, and the reunification of families.
Well, I think from what I hear, there are travel restrictions and bans on other people, particularly those who have some differences of opinion or politics with the ruling regime or for other reasons.
Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department, which is ironically on friendly terms with the UAE, has released a hard-hitting report on human rights practices in the country. According to the report, the government revoked the citizenship of 19 relatives of 2 dissidents, banned 30 relatives of 6 dissidents from traveling, and barred 22 relatives of 3 dissidents from renewing their identity documents. In all cases, authorities allegedly cited state security reasons.
You can't use WhatsApp in these countries. Access to internet is restricted in the Emirates in particular. Even non-harmful websites with political news or views, you're not able to access them from inside the Emirates. The Emirates also banned has banned, has a broad definition of terrorism, which extends to lots of non-violent politics, political groups, and even charities as well that they disagree with.
The fact is that attempts by the UAE security apparatus to pressure the relatives of political dissidents residing abroad have reached an alarming level. Without renewed passports and identity cards, they're deprived of their most basic rights to basic services. Many of them can no longer work, study, access health services, or even a driver's license. The case of the Al-Nuwaymis is just a tiny fraction of what the Emirati authorities commit against those who think differently. A graphic example of injustice and collective punishment running deep beneath the modern veneer of the United Arab Emirates.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of campaigners representing indigenous communities, young people, and civil society groups recently poured into the hallways of the venue of COP, chanting, "Keep 1.5 degrees Celsius alive," and condemning political leaders for failing to deliver an agreement that will limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by the end of the century. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is titled, "Leaders at COP26 Are Massively Killing the Paris Agreement," critics say. Stay tuned for more. Hundreds of campaigners representing indigenous communities, young people, and civil society groups recently poured into the hallways of the venue of COP26 chanting, "Keep 1.5 degrees Celsius alive," and condemning political leaders for failing to deliver an agreement that will limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by the end of the century. Advocates called the demonstration a people's plenary and proceeded out into the street for a rally with members of Extinction Rebellion and Fridays for Future. "This is the real atmosphere of people fighting for their needs," Kata Rizna Neymer, a climate activist from Poland, told the Washington Post. Despite warnings from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC,